For all its beauty and splendor, the ocean can be a cruel teacher. Commercial diving is one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. One wrong move, one faulty line, one careless second, and you're gone. No second chances. No mercy. The work is ugly and hard. Your body fights the strain, your lungs beg for air, and your mind wrestles with fear. In the end, you hope for one thing, that when it's your turn, if it comes, you'll go quick. The sea doesn't promise anything, but it takes everything if you let it. Let's venture back to the unforgiving ocean where survival is earned, not given. This is Outdoor Disasters. For the five divers of LMCS Limited, their maintenance dive would be a nightmare. The Gulf of Paria on the island of Trinidad and Tobago was a familiar scene the men had seen 100 times before, but there was a peculiar stillness in the air that morning, as if the sea itself was holding its breath. Originally named the Gulf of the Whale by Christopher Columbus, the region's whale population was decimated by 19th century whaling, and it has never recovered. Geologically, the Gulf of Paria is situated within the strike-slip boundary zone of the southeastern Caribbean. Its structure comprises a network of trans-tension basins layered over the fold and thrust belt of Venezuela's Serranía del Interior. The region's petroleum reserves originated from prolific Upper Cretaceous source rocks, subsequently buried under thick paleogene deposits of deepwater shales, sandstones, and shallow marine siliciclastic reservoirs. The movement of the Caribbean plate caused transpression, creating distinct sub-basins across Trinidad, each with its own unique petroleum system. In the sultry haze of a Trinidadian day on February 25, 2022, five seasoned divers, Christopher Boudram, Faisal Kerbin, Yusuf Henry, Kazim Ali Jr., and Rishi Nagasar, prepared for what seemed a routine assignment to help the local company extract the resources. Contracted by Paria Fuel Trading Company, their task was to perform maintenance on a dormant underwater oil pipeline near Pointe-à-Pierre, a town cradled by the Gulf of Paria. The pipeline, a colossal 30-inch diameter steel serpent, slumbered beneath the waves, its dark maw stretching from berth 5 to berth 6, a conduit once pulsating with crude oil. The team was a part of LMCS Limited, a local contractor specializing in underwater operations. Kazim Ali Jr., whose father owned LMCS, was a man of quiet confidence with lines etched on his face by years of labor and salt air. Diving was in his blood. He had grown up near the sea, and its dangers were as familiar to him as its beauty. Yusuf Henry was the joker of the group, always quick with a quip or a story. He had a way of easing the tension before a dive, yet his humor never dulled his skill. Faisal Kerbin, the eldest and the lead diver of the group, had a reputation for thoroughness, for seeing the things others missed. The sea was unpredictable, and he respected that. He didn't believe in taking chances. Rishi Nagasar is a man of faith. His prayers were not just for safety, but for strength, clarity, and the ability to face whatever awaited them below. Christopher Boudram, the youngest of the group, was the latest to join the team. The older men had taken him under their wing, teasing him, but teaching him, passing down the knowledge that only years in the water could provide. The job was straightforward on paper. Remove an inline plug from a 30-inch pipeline running 60 feet below the surface. The pipeline belonged to the Paria Fuel Trading Company, a state-owned entity responsible for fuel and energy operations. It was maintenance work, routine in theory, though any diver would tell you that routine work underwater was never truly routine. The men were to work on a large underwater U-shaped pipe. It consisted of two risers. When operational, ships would dock at the first riser, berth 5, and the oil would run through the pipe up to berth 6, where it was then sucked up into the refinery for further use. The men were planning to work in a hyperbaric chamber they had created to be able to work and breathe normally while underwater. The habitat was a crude cube, 8 feet by 8, suspended like an iron lantern over the yawning mouth of the pipe. The sea pressed against it with unrelenting weight, a hostile force held at bay by the air forced inside to displace the water. Within this strange chamber, the men could strip off their diving gear, breathe freely, and wield their tools with purpose. The work was slow, deliberate, and made heavier by the knowledge that one wrong move could bring the ocean crashing back down upon them. The chamber at Berth 6 was ready. They finished gearing up for the dive and jumped into the water like any other day. But today, it would not go as planned. As they prepared to descend, the team moved with the practiced choreography of men who had worked together for years. Equipment was checked and rechecked, masks tightened, and lines secured. The team entered the water one by one. The gulf closed over them, and the world above faded away. They were now in the realm of the sea, a place of shadows and silence, where the only sounds were the rhythmic hiss of their breath and the muted hum of their equipment. This day, their task was removing an inflatable plug at Berth 6. The plug had been jammed into the pipe's throat nearly 2 weeks earlier, a last-ditch effort to trap the pipe's black heart, 1,200 barrels of oil, away from the sea's grasp. It was a tight, air-sealed barrier, a rubber sentinel braced against the tremendous pressure from above. But now it had to go, and the men set about their grim duty. The divers reached the chamber, stripped of their heavy gear, and moved to their task with the quiet confidence of men accustomed to danger. The air inside was thick and damp, carrying the sharp, bitter scent of oil. They spoke in short bursts, clipped and measured. This was routine work, nothing to worry about. They were here to remove the airtight plug, the seal that kept the pipeline dormant. A simple job. They had done this before, but not today. Today things would not go as they had planned. The plug was stubborn. The five men gathered around the pipe. The wrench groaned in their hands as they twisted the valve on the plug. The tools groaned against its weight, the sound carrying a strange menace in the tight space. They pushed harder, gritting their teeth, muscles straining. The seal shifted, a reluctant giant, and then, without warning, the world roared to life. In the blink of an eye, the sea turned on them. The chamber buckled. A deafening explosion of sound and force hit them all at once. The first sound was a low, guttural roar, the kind of noise you feel in your bones before you hear it. The air seemed to tear itself apart as water surged into the habitat, swallowing the space where the men had stood moments before. The walls seemed to fold inward, collapsing like a house of cards under the crushing grip of water and pressure. The ocean rushed in, furious and cold, and the men were no longer standing. The pipe became a ravenous throat, pulling in everything, wrenches, tanks, men, into its gaping blackness. The force was unimaginable, a torrent of water and air swirling with the fury of a storm. They were no longer in control. The pipe took them. It was not a slow thing. It was instant, brutal, and merciless. What they were experiencing was a phenomenon called delta P, or differential pressure, which is the difference in pressure between two points in a system. It is a critical concept in fluid mechanics and engineering, used to understand how fluids move through pipelines, valves, filters, or other systems. Delta P hazards occur when there is a significant pressure difference between two areas, such as the inside and outside of a pipe or barrier, causing fluid to rush violently through a small opening. These situations can create extremely dangerous forces capable of sucking objects or even people into the opening. The vacuum yanked them into the abyss, their bodies torn from the chamber as if they weighed nothing. The water was everywhere, filling their mouths, their ears, their lungs. Darkness wrapped around them, absolute and unforgiving. The pipeline was alive now, a steel serpent swallowing its prey. They were flung down its length, tossed like driftwood in a raging sea. Their equipment, their tools, their very breaths, everything was stripped away. The cold metal walls battered them as they plunged deeper into the void. It was endless, a tunnel of black water and steel that offered no escape, no light, no hope. The noise was deafening, the rush of water like a storm that would never end. Thank you. They came to rest in the darkness. The pipe had spared them for now, leaving them battered and bruised, scattered in its belly. They gasped for air, clinging to the tiny pockets that remained. The water pressed around them, heavy and still. One man yelled, "We're inside the pipe, man!" They were able to account for everyone. They were alive for now. But the pipe was not finished with them. They landed, gasping, in a pocket of air, trapped like a cruel joke within the pipe. It wasn't the breath of salvation, it was a taunt, the same air that had betrayed them and sucked them into this hellish tomb. Their voices echoed in the cramped space, shouting questions, expletives, anything to drown out the sound of their own panic. The GoPro strapped to one of the men's helmets had captured it all. The moment they were pulled under, the black nothingness and then the raspy shouts in the dark. The five men, battered and bleeding, found themselves in a miracle, a small air pocket deep within the black heart of the pipe. The water was icy, pressing against them, but here, in this fragile bubble of life, they could breathe. For a moment, they were alive, and that was something. Their breaths came ragged, harsh against the silence, each man taking stock of the pain lancing through his body. Cuts and bruises marked their flesh. Some wounds they couldn't see but felt with every shallow breath. It was dark, utterly dark, but not silent. The pipe groaned faintly, an ominous reminder that this refuge was temporary. They spoke in whispers, their voices low and resolute. They knew they couldn't stay. If they waited, the air would run out and they'd suffocate in the wet, cold tomb. They linked themselves together, locking legs under arms, gripping one another like lifelines in the darkness. There was no plan, only movement. A slow, agonizing crawl forward. Disorientation was their enemy, and it clung to them as tightly as the thick oil coating their bodies. The pipe was a labyrinth, 1,200 feet or 365 meters of steel and darkness, stretching out like the spine of some ancient beast. They had no idea how far they'd been carried, how deep they were, or even which way was back to berth 6. The pipeline was not a straight path. Weld seams and structural supports had created undulations, rises and falls, where pockets of air had formed. They had settled in one of those air pockets, battered but breathing. In the dim cacophony of their minds, the realization dawned. Alive, yes, but for how long? There was no consensus on which direction would lead them to salvation. Panic bubbled under the surface as they argued. The oil was everywhere, on their skin, in their eyes, burning their nostrils. The pipe offered no mercy. Their progress was agonizingly slow. Each movement a war against the oil and their broken bodies. Ribs cracked, joints swollen, and lungs still aching from the water they had swallowed. Yusuf groaned with every step. Rishi's face was a mask of silent agony. Chris led the group, steady but grim. Behind him was Fizel Kerben, determined but already faltering. And then they saw it. The seawater was rising. At first, it was just a cold kiss against their waists, then their chests. Soon the man at the front, Chris, found his face inches from the top of the pipe. There was no room to stand upright, only to tilt their heads and breathe in shallow gasps. Some of the men could barely stand, let alone swim. It was then, in the growing chaos, that Chris and Faisal decided to break away and find more air and come back for them. The others didn't protest. They nodded, their eyes hollow. Their bodies sinking deeper into the oil and water. Chris and Faisal inhaled as deeply as they could, heads tilted back to scrape the last inches of air. Then they dove, swimming blindly into the oily darkness, hands scraping the walls of the pipe for any sign of salvation. The swim was hell. The oil clung to their faces, choking their eyes and burning their throats. Faisal's injuries slowed him. His strokes were weaker with every pull. But just when they thought the blackness would consume them, their heads broke the surface into another air pocket. They gasped, coughing violently, clutching at the slick walls of the pipe. Relief flooded them when they saw it. Two scuba tanks resting against the wall. It felt like a miracle. The tanks gave them hope, but it was fragile and fleeting. Fizal's strength was fading fast. His breathing was shallow, his movement sluggish. They knew what must be done and decided that Chris, the least injured person, would push on. There was no time to argue. Chris adjusted the tank, taking one last look at Fizal before turning toward the narrowing tunnel ahead. The pipe constricted to a mere 2.5 feet or 76 centimeters, forcing him to push the tank in front of him as he crawled forward. It was slow, grueling work. The tank scraped against the walls, and his breathing echoed in his ears louder than his own heartbeat. And then a terrifying thought struck him. What if this is the wrong end? If he emerged at berth 5, he'd find nothing but the inflated plug sealing the pipe shut. There would be no air, no escape, and no second chances. His tank was nearly empty. Chris muttered a prayer under his breath, pushed off the bottom, and swam upward. The climb was an eternity, the weight of his exhaustion pressing down on him. But then his head broke the surface and he saw it. Berth 6. Chris screamed, pounding against the steel walls, his voice raw and desperate. The searchers heard him, a faint, ghostly sound echoing through the chaos above. A chain was lowered, and Chris clawed his way out, his body trembling with exhaustion. "They're alive," he gasped, barely able to form the words. "There's air in the pipe. They're hurt, but they're alive." The rescuers moved quickly, their urgency matching Chris's desperation. Chris had made it out, but the fight for survival was far from over. Rescue efforts were launched immediately, but the challenges were immense. The pipeline, which stretched over 30 inches or 76 centimeters in diameter and ran horizontally for hundreds of feet, posed significant risks. Inside the confined space, the divers faced pitch darkness, low oxygen levels, and exposure to hydrocarbons. Adding to the complexity, the pipeline's intricate bends and the high-pressure environment made navigation perilous. Initially, divers from LMCS, Pariah, and independent volunteers offered to enter the pipeline in a desperate attempt to locate and rescue the trapped men. Equipment, including oxygen tanks, rope lines, and underwater cameras, were quickly gathered to facilitate the operation. However, the situation demanded specialized expertise, and soon, calls were made to bring in external diving teams with experience in confined space rescues. As resources were mobilized, delays began to emerge. Pariah Fuel Trading Company raised concerns about the structural integrity of the pipeline and the potential risks of further collapses or explosions. This led to the company halting attempts by independent divers to enter the pipeline, including Chris, who had to be restrained from entering back into the pipeline. Many on-site expressed frustration at the slow pace of the mobilization, emphasizing the importance of acting swiftly in such life-threatening conditions. Chris was then taken to the hospital, his body battered and his mind reeling. But even as he drifted into unconsciousness, one thought remained clear. The others were still in that pipe, clinging to life in the dark. External experts, including those specializing in underwater pipeline operations, were consulted to develop a rescue plan. However, the complexity of the pipeline's layout and the lack of real-time information about the trapped divers' conditions posed significant challenges. Efforts were further hindered by logistical issues, including the availability of high-resolution imaging equipment to map the pipeline's interior. The families of the missing divers and members of the public grew increasingly agitated as hours passed without concrete action. Volunteer divers, willing to risk their lives, were turned away due to safety regulations enforced by Pariah. Some divers who had prepared to enter the pipeline described the decision as agonizing, feeling that every moment of inaction reduced the chances of survival for their colleagues. Eventually, drones with cameras and sensors were deployed to assess the pipeline's interior. Despite these efforts, the rescue operation shifted to recovery as days passed without signs of life. Experts later criticized the lack of preparedness and the absence of a dedicated emergency response plan for such incidents, which further complicated the mobilization of rescue teams. The decision to suspend rescue operations sparked intense debate and became a focal point of criticism. Witnesses, including personnel at the scene, recounted the frustration of seeing willing divers prepared to enter the pipeline, but prevented from doing so by Pariah's safety protocols. These accounts highlighted the emotional toll on experienced divers who felt they could have made a difference in the critical hours following the accident. Pariah's justification for halting direct intervention centered on safety concerns, including the risks of additional suction events, pipeline instability, and potential fatalities among rescuers. However, this cautious approach faced backlash from the public and the divers' families, who accused the company of prioritizing assets and liability over human lives. There were claims that knocking inside the pipes could be heard up to 3 days after the incident. At some point, the knocking ceased, and it was far too late for rescue of the four remaining men. Days later, the bodies of Faisal Kurban, Yusuf Henry, Kazim Ali Jr., and Rishi Nagasser were recovered from inside the pipeline. Reports later revealed that local and international diving experts had been consulted during the response, with some recommending aggressive rescue measures while others emphasized caution. The conflicting advice contributed to delays and indecision. Critics argued that the lack of immediate action during the critical initial hours was a missed opportunity to save lives. In the days following the incident, tensions escalated as families of the trapped divers camped outside Pariah's facility, demanding transparency and updates. The absence of clear communication from the company fueled public outrage. The controversy also spurred calls for systemic reforms, with advocates pointing to the need for more robust safety regulations and better training for handling industrial emergencies. The government established a commission of inquiry to investigate the circumstances surrounding the incident. During these hearings, Chris Boodram would testify, recalling the nightmarish ordeal. Before the commissioners, Boodram fought through tears to recount the horror. His voice broke often, but he pressed on. He described crawling his injured body through the suffocating blackness of a 30-inch oil-filled pipeline, his arms screaming in pain. "At that point, I told myself I would die. I said to God, 'I am coming.' I thought of my mother and asked her to look out for me," Chris recalled. At the pipe's opening, Boodram clung to a chain, screaming and banging for help. When he saw the light, he thought it was the angel of death, but it was rescue. Boodram pleaded for the others to be saved, but the rescue was slow and an ambulance took him to the hospital. Unearthed during the commission, it was revealed that just 12 hours after the divers were pulled into the pipeline, Pariah's management began drafting press releases to declare the men dead and extend condolences to their families. This, despite desperate pleas from the families and the lone survivor, who insisted the men were still alive, as well as volunteers urging for a rescue effort. The autopsies uncovered a chilling reality. Faisal Kurban, Rishi Nagasser, Kazim, and Yusuf Henry could have survived for up to 3 days. In November 2023, at the conclusion of the commission hearings, Chairman Jerome Lynch stated, "This was no act of God or mere unlucky accident," indicating that the tragedy was preventable. The commission's report described the company's actions as grossly negligent and recommended charges of corporate manslaughter against Pariah. It also called for prosecuting specific individuals, including senior officials, under the Occupational Safety and Health Act. The report highlighted how safety protocols were either inadequately implemented or ignored entirely, contributing to the tragedy. In September 2024, legal proceedings formally commenced, with Pariah's general manager, Mushtaq Mohammed, terminal operations manager, Colin Piper, and LMCS director, Kazim Ali Sr., facing 15 charges under the OSH Act. The charges ranged from failing to prepare an adequate emergency plan to neglecting worker safety during high-risk operations. All parties pleaded not guilty, and the trial is ongoing. All four of the men would be laid to rest shortly after the incident. Faisal Kurban had a special send-off for him, including a casket in the shape of a boat. Kurban's son Michael said his father loved the sea and had been a diver for a long time. Michael and his brother Nicholas are also divers and were part of the initial rescue team for the men when the incident occurred off Pariah's Berth 6. Yusuf Henry's mother delivered the eulogy at his funeral. She thanked those who stood with the family and said while her son may not have been perfect, he was hardworking, a loving father of four. He was the life of the party and impacted almost anyone he met. He left a hole that will never be filled. I am hurting, but we will use this moment to bring calm. We have a true and existing God as God got me, she said. Hundreds of mourners lined the streets of Perseverance Village, Kuva, to say goodbye to Rishi Nagasar. The casket was sealed, adorned with flowers, and engraved with an angelic personification of Nagasar. A smiling photo of him stood nearby where his wife Vanessa wept. During the funeral, Rishi's niece Baharilal told the love story of Nagasar and Vanessa, who had met 13 years before when she worked at a restaurant. He always sweet-talked her and called her curly hair. He used to say he dreamt of a girl with curly hair, and she was the woman of his dreams, she said. While the wives and mothers of the other fallen divers comforted Vanessa, she gazed at the coffin and cried. Officiating pundit said the family was still in shock and disbelief. However, he said despite the problems, they could not allow themselves to carry the burden of the tragedy. I want you today to not put any blame in any way, not our nation, the government, or the company. Let us not put blame on anyone. Let us not carry that burden, he said. Christopher Boodrum, the lone survivor, limped toward the coffin of his friend Kazim Ali Jr., grief etched into every step. At the funeral held near the LMCS compound in Marabella, he bent low, hugging the casket, his sobs breaking the heavy silence. Ali's father, Kazim Ali Sr., placed a hand on Boodrum's shoulder as colleagues in company uniform stood nearby, sharing the weight of the moment. Family and friends gathered to honor Ali Jr., a son, father, and husband remembered for his bravery and devotion. His wife, Jamie, spoke through tears. He was our provider, protector, and joy. Rest easy, love, we'll be taken care of. The Imam called for courage in Ali's memory. Life is fleeting, but Kazim lived fully, brave, industrious, and caring. The sea took them and it did not give them back, but they were men who lived with purpose, who faced the depths with courage, and who knew the risks that came with their calling. What happened to them was cruel and hard, but their story is not only of loss, it is of strength. It is of men who worked together, who trusted one another, and who would have fought for each other until the end. Their families stood tall in grief, bearing the weight of what was taken but never forgetting what was left. Love, memory, and the legacy of lives well lived, however short. There is no fairness in the way fate chooses, no mercy in its taking, but there is honor in the way they lived, and perhaps that is the best a man can hope for, to leave behind a story that will not be forgotten. They were divers, they were fathers, brothers, sons, and they were brave. Some people go where others won't, where the air is thin or the water presses down like a fist. They climb, dive, and descend into the unknown, not for glory but because the job must be done. The world runs on their work, though few ever think of them. The bridges stand, the ships sail, the oil flows, and somewhere out there, a man is in the dark, wrench in hand, fighting the sea or the steel or both. It is not a clean life, it is not an easy one. The sea does not care about their courage or their skill. It waits to take them, and sometimes it does. They know this. They've seen the scars on the faces of the old-timers who lived through it. They've heard the stories of those who didn't. And still, they go. Because that's the life. Because someone has to do it. There is honor in their work, though it is hard and silent. They do not ask for thanks or recognition. They know no medals wait for the man who welds at depth or fixes what is broken under the weight of the sea. Their reward is simpler. A job done right, a paycheck, and maybe the chance to come home. But not all of them do. For those men, there are no parades, no headlines, just the sound of the waves and the weight of their memory on the shoulders of the ones left behind. It is harsh, but it is the truth. And the men who know it, they go anyway. Understanding fully, there's a very good chance they'll experience an outdoor disaster. If you've made it this far, please consider clicking those subscribe and like buttons. Want more outdoor disasters content? Check out these videos I believe you'll enjoy. Thank you for watching.